we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria today.
No, I intuitively had to pause there because, you know, I was waiting for Maria to go first, and she didn't.
You've been trained.
Yes, exactly. She kind of insists on it. Anyway, how are you?
Not too bad for another fine Saturday here in the Empire.
Yeah, it's like we're having our summer in September. It's kind of odd. But I'm not complaining.
The sun is certainly shining down on those that want another sports palace this week.
Yes, yes. Although usually they want that sports palace because they want a team to play in it, and they're contrary to a lot of the media coverage, that still seems like a slim hope. But I'll get to that in a moment. First, we want to talk about the deal that city council members cut with arena developer Chris Hansen on Tuesday. The new deal did have some improvements to it. The provisions that were new were Hansen paying $40 million into a transportation fund that would alleviate some of the congestion that might occur around SoTo and the Port of Seattle as a result of arena traffic, and another $7 million for a study to figure out what to do with Key Arena and Seattle Center. It requires an environmental impact statement, which in turn would has been a sticking point for a lot of people that for some magical reason the arena was not supposed to have any environmental impact. That was the stance of the city before. So that's a good thing, and that also requires looking at alternative sites for an arena, which is kind of ridiculous since looking at no site at all is not part of that. And frankly, given that Hansen has already purchased the property, I doubt they're going to be looking very closely at alternative sites. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, Hansen signed an agreement that he would cover cost overruns for the building of the arena. So that resolves the issue that McGinn was very concerned about and a lot of other arena critics were very concerned about over the last year or two with the tunnel, which is, you know, what happens with inevitable cost runs with a major construction project. So that part, those parts were all to the good. The interesting thing about this is that advocates for this new deal were talking about how this now brings the city of Seattle into compliance with Referendum 91, which was the initiative that was passed a few years ago overwhelmingly by Seattle voters that said any new arena deal had to pencil out for the city and actually make a certain level of profit as opposed to costing taxpayers money. That suggests that they knew that it didn't comply with R91 before, even though they were saying with the old deal that had already passed county council that in fact was in compliance with R91, even though opponents of the arena were saying that it wasn't. And it's curious that they say that this the new changes bring it into compliance because, frankly, nothing in the new agreements, even though many of them are positive, affects the actual operating costs of the arena or how much it will cost up front to taxpayers. You have transportation costs, you have a Key Arena fund, you have an environmental impact statement, you have cost overruns. But, you know, nothing in there affects whether the arena itself is going to be profitable. Nothing in there affects how much the arena is going to cost to be built. And nothing affects how much of the cost of being built is going to be absorbed by taxpayers, unless there's a cost overrun that would have otherwise been picked up by taxpayers, but that wasn't the R91 concern. So I found that fairly interesting. But the really kind of outrageous portion of all that is that 2 days, 48 hours after this deal was announced, with no public hearing, with no public testimony, with no meetings whatsoever, the City Council's Government Performance and Finance Committee approved 7-0 with Nick Licata abstaining. That is, 8 of the 9 City Council members are on this committee. They approved it on Thursday. There was no opportunity, none at all, for public input on this new deal. And there's a full council vote that's going to be scheduled a week from Monday on the 24th of September. But again, you would have to turn around at least 3, maybe more people who have voted yes already in order for that vote to have a different outcome. So the question is, why the fast track? Why was it why were they in such a rip-roaring hurry to get this thing passed that they were willing to completely sidetrack any sort of public input into the New Deal?
In a city known for its process.
Yes, in a city where we talk constantly about the Seattle Way talking about things endlessly. Now, mind you, I'm in the case of things like the Seattle Viaduct, I'm not particularly in favor of taking 10 years to make a decision, but 48 hours seems a little precipitous to me. So that is the arena. And as I mentioned, a lot of the coverage of this is a giant step toward getting a new franchise for the city of Seattle. Well, no, it's not. And that's true for a couple of reasons. Number one is that if you're talking about trying to attract a basketball team, an NBA team, you know, we already have a perfectly serviceable arena in the city of Seattle, and a team could play there for a couple of years while a new arena was being built. So it wasn't an impediment at all that, you know, this wasn't already under construction. But the really important piece of that is that there are very, very few teams in either the NBA or the NHL, let alone both at the same time, that move. I mean, it only happens about once every maybe 5 or 6 years in the NHL, and even less frequently in the NBA. And there are, in the case of either league, three or four other cities that already have arenas built that are already lobbying to try and get a team there. In the case of the NBA, Anaheim in Kansas City and Anaheim, Orange County, has a much larger population than King County does, and has a much larger adjacent counties in terms of LA and San Diego than King County does. So it's a larger market. In the case of the NHL, there are several Canadian cities that are trying to lure teams, most notably Quebec City, because they already had a team once, and they have a much more energized and fervent fan base. Hartford, which also used to be in the NHL, has built a new arena and is trying to lure a team back, and so on and so forth. So there's relatively few opportunities. Even if you get a team at the first opportunity, it might be several years out, and there's no guarantee at all that you're going to do that. And it's not necessarily something you have control over. It's whoever owns the team already that decides who they want to sell to. And for whatever reason, it's not necessarily because a new buyer is in a larger market or even is waving around the most money. So it could still be a long, long time after this arena is built before there's a professional team in there. And ask Kansas City, as an example, who built their new arena some years ago now and has failed to attract either an NBA or an NHL team, what that white elephant looks like.
And then with the new MOU the modified MOU not addressing the R91 issue, wouldn't you anticipate that would be challenged in court?
I would expect that it will be. Now, there are different interpretations from impartial people who have looked at this as to whether it complies with R91 or not. So I'd be pretty surprised if it weren't challenged.
Okay. All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. People for Puget Sound.
Yeah. Sad news in the environmental community this week. People for Puget Sound, which has been really the leading organization in terms of the effort to clean up Puget Sound over the last 30, 40 years, announced this week that basically had run out of money and was going to disband. Now, they're going to transfer some of the preservation and research and cleanup programs that they do to the Washington Environmental Council and Earth Corps. Those agreements aren't firm yet, but in the People for Puget Sound announcement, they said they were in quote unquote serious discussions, and I'm sure on all sides they very much want to make that happen because it is valuable work and they do want to make it continue. But once again, why is it that that kind of work and has to come from a nonprofit that has to raise its own money when there's such an enormous amount of public good that comes out of that work? Why isn't that more of a state funding and original funding priority? And even to the point of providing funding support for groups like Puget, people from Puget Sound to do the work themselves, which they're obviously for a number of years already been doing. They've had a tremendous impact over the years on actually making for a cleaner Puget Sound. If people lived here 30 or 40 years ago, they might have some memory of how bad things were then, and they really have dramatically improved over that time. And certainly there have been government efforts around things like, you know, stormwater runoff and other things that have made a huge difference. But to see a group like that has been such a cornerstone of those efforts go away when there's a lot of work left to be done is troubling on a number of levels.
All right. Moving on, Rob McKenna.
Yeah, there's been kind of an amusing little side story to the gubernatorial campaign over the last number of months, which is Rob McKenna's thick skin, telling questioners to get a job, running away from TV cameramen, and his refusal to allow reporters from The Stranger to attend any of his public press conferences of McKenna as an elected statewide official. The McKenna campaign let slip this week an actual sensible rationalization, besides they don't like me, for why he won't allow The Stranger to attend his press conferences. And it was kind of an interesting rationale. McKenna was claiming that he wouldn't let them in because The Stranger is biased, because Dan Savage, who he's not the publisher, that's Tim Keck, but he's basically one notch below the publisher and what he wants at The Stranger gets done. He's much more than a sex advice columnist at that paper. Gave Inslee's PAC money. And because one of the paper's reporters, David Goldstein, who writes in the paper as Goldie, has supported Democrats in the past. So I got curious about this, and of course, for any reporter, the best friend is the PDC, where you can actually look at contributions to different campaigns. And this story ran on last Monday, the 10th, and the PDC files are now updated through the 8th. So it's not like if there's been contributions, they wouldn't have shown up. And oddly enough, there's no record of Dan Savage, who obviously could have cited a different employer since he wears a number of his hats, different media and nonprofit hats. No record of Savage having given to either campaign. No record of David Goldstein having given to either campaign, and nobody from The Stranger having given to any campaign. On the other hand, somebody from Seattle Times gave Rob McKenna $250, and I'm thinking, well, shouldn't the Seattle Times be excluded from McKenna's press conferences? But I don't think Rob McKenna rolls that way, because the Seattle Times seems to like him an awful lot.
Mm.
Just saying. So, once again, we have Rob McKenna. There's a couple different possibilities here. One is that Savage wrote about giving Inslee money and he was lying, or it's under his spouse's name, or, you know, whatever. But an equally, if not more plausible explanation is that McKenna's pulling stuff out of his butt.
Okay.
Just saying.
All right, let's move on to national and the Chicago teacher strike.
Yeah, there's a tentative resolution this morning to the Chicago teacher strike. Probably as we speak, they're holed up in some, because Chicago is probably where the term smoke-filled room came from, so we'll stick with that, trying to hammer out the details. There's been an enormous amount of misinformation in national media about what this strike is about. And they talked about this a little bit on Counterspin in the last half hour also. A lot of the media coverage has been focusing on how much the teachers already make and so on and so forth, but that is only relevant in that is the only wages and benefits are the only legal reason why teachers in the state of Illinois can strike. But the real issues behind the new contract are that the teachers are being asked for 20% more work in terms of the longer work school days that have been implemented under new mayor and former Obama chief of staff Rahm Emanuel. 2% more pay for that 20% more work. The contract is tied to doubling the state requirement of relying on test results for merit pay, and doing that in the only major urban district in the state where it's, you know, much more difficult to get good test results because of any number of things that might be going on in the homes of the students, and English as a second language and a larger percentage of special needs students and so forth. this really, and the backstory behind it is that Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the former Obama aide, has a lot of financial connections to the charter school industry, the commercial charter school industry. And the contract, sure enough, and the Chicago budget is trying to put more money into charter schools. And that's really a lot of what this strike is about, and a lot of why both sides had drawn lines in the sand and it had been such a bitter strike over the past several days. So it's going to be very interesting for the tentative deal. None of the compromises have been announced yet. That'll happen in the next day or two, I expect. But it's going to be very interesting to see where they came down on that, because that really is the crux of what this is about. It's about paying teachers to be working more. And, of course, you know, teachers do not have a six-hour workday. Anybody who's ever been or been married to a teacher knows that they spend a lot of time outside the school working on their classrooms and working on their teaching material. And it's about putting public money into non-public schools.
And that's one of the big battles that's happening across the United States as well.
Yes.
Here with
it. And you're seeing now, one of the other interesting things about this is now you're seeing centrist corporate identified Democrats, as well as Republicans. And by Democrats, I'm thinking of people like Emanuel and Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, joining Republicans in like, Scott Walker, Christie in New Jersey, Kasich in Ohio, in trying to get political benefit from bashing unions. And, once again, this is all about where their money comes from and who their political patrons are. We're seeing this more and more. And you have to wonder if Rob McKenna is going to be the next on that list, because he's been very, very critical of state employees. On that note, also yesterday, a Wisconsin judge struck down Scott Walker's law ending public employee collective bargaining rights. He let stand that part of the law for state employees, but he struck it down for county, local, and school district employees, which are the vast majority of public employees in Wisconsin, on the grounds that Walker excluded, as a sort of a craven political stance, since they're more conservative unions, police and firefighters unions. According to the decision, and this is a direct quote, the law singles out and encumbers the rights of those employees who choose union membership and representation solely because of that association, and therefore infringes upon rights of free speech and association guaranteed by both the Wisconsin and U.S. constitutions. And you think if it's a free speech, free association issue, and it's covered under the U.S. Constitution, that might also cover a number of the other states where cracking down on public sector unions has been a real issue and a real problem. A federal judge already struck down two other provisions of Walker's law in March. And, of course, Walker and the Wisconsin Republicans have said they're going to appeal that.
All right. Moving on then, the Department of Homeland Security came out with a report.
Yeah, they did. Record number of deportations under the Obama administration in 2011. 391,953 people shipped out of the United States, even though the number of illegal border crossings last year was at a 40-year low. 93% of the people deported were from four countries, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, suggesting that an awful lot of people are coming north because of free trade agreements and because of the war on drugs. Free trade agreements because it makes rural jobs much harder to come by because of cheap American food products and agricultural products being dumped in the country, and the war on drugs, particularly in Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras, because of the violence that accompanies that and people fleeing that violence. They may be coming here because of their own poverty, but they're also coming here because of the policies of the United States and Obama being much more aggressive in shipping them out than any of his predecessors, including George W. Bush. Even though Obama, the other piece of it is that even though Obama announced in June a suspension of the policy deporting minors, deporting kids, and drew a lot of criticism from Republicans for that unilateral decision, none of those deportations have yet been deferred. They're still trying to work out the regulations. So it was a very nicely timed announcement for the purposes of the election, but it has not actually gone into effect.
All right. Well, let's move on then to this week in the alternate universe.
Yeah, the Republican National Convention, the polls and viewership numbers are now in, and the RNC convention in Tampa was now the first convention ever to have a negative bounce for its candidate. A CNN poll showing that what happened in Tampa, which did not unfortunately stay in Tampa, made 36% of respondents more likely to vote for Mitt Romney. And 46% more likely to vote for Barack Obama. Equally interesting was the numbers of the impact of the Republican convention on House races. Before the convention, you had a 42-37 split for generic House races between Democrats and Republicans, Democrats having the 42. After the convention, you had 41, almost the same for Democrats, but 32, 5 points lower for Republicans. Now, that's a little misleading since though that Democrats are ahead in those numbers because that was a national poll rather than by district. And because of Republican gerrymandering in a lot of state legislatures after the 2010 census, that isn't necessarily going to translate into Democratic wins, because more Democrats are concentrated in heavily one-party districts. If you want to think of how this works, you can have, for instance, one district that's 90% Democrat and three districts that are, say there's 10 votes, so there's 9 Democrats, 1 Republican. Then you have 3 districts that are only 4 Democrat and 6 Republican. Well, the 40-60 Republicans are usually going to win those districts. The total is 21-19. You have more Democrats overall than you do Republicans, but Republicans have won 3 of the 4 districts. That's how gerrymandering works, and you're going to see a lot of that in 2012 and moving forward until 2020 or longer.
And no feedback yet from the DNC as to how they bumped?
The preliminary polls are that there was a little bit of a bump for Obama, not significant. Usually in these conventions, the challenger gets a bigger bounce because the incumbent is better known. And that's true for both the Democrats and Republicans. So that's not particularly a surprise, but Romney driving people away in droves, is a surprise. And we'll talk about, Romney's predilection for doing that shortly. I did want to mention also, in this week in the alternate universe, state Republican Representative Jim Bucci and his well-thought-out opposition to abortion, and I'm sure he speaks for a lot of quote-unquote pro-life people on this. Quote, "Well, there's probably a lot of dash. I'm not a woman, so I'm thinking, if I'm a woman, why would I want to get... some of it has to do with economics. A lot has to do with economics. I don't know. I have never... It's a question I've never thought about." End quote. Now, aside from Mr. Bucci's remarkable... non-eloquence, if a vengeful fairy godmother ever gave little Jimmy a vagina, he'd probably think a lot more about it. I'm just saying. He'd probably also be single, but that's another question. And finally, in the alternate universe, we did want to talk about Mitt Romney putting his foot in it over the embassy protests and tragedies in Egypt and Libya this week. He accused Obama in his initial response on, I believe it was Tuesday night, of, quote, sympathizing with protesters for, which was wrong on several accounts. Number one, what he was apparently referring to was a tweet by the embassy in Cairo that was tweeted before the protest to try to head off the anger of Muslims in that country, and as it turned out also in Libya and elsewhere, over a truly dreadful, bigoted, and hateful, and as well as badly made movie trailer put out by some anti-Muslim bigots, including Terry Jones, the same church pastor in Florida who made a name for himself internationally by threatening to burn a Quran last year. Well, he's back. Romney is saying that Obama sympathizes with people who kill American diplomats, and at that time also the fact that there had been fatalities in Benghazi in Libya was not yet known. The tweet in Cairo was a local embassy thing. It was not approved by the State Department, let alone by Obama. So it was wrong on a number of counts, and particularly it was inappropriate because, you know, you've just had 4 State Department people, including an ambassador, murdered as a result of protesters. you do not go out and immediately try to blame the president and politicize something like that. And as a result, you had pretty much all of official Washington, including most of the leadership, except for the true Kool-Aid drinkers in the Republican Party, also blasting Romney simply for being inappropriate, as well as some people were actually disturbed by the fact that once again he was terribly factually wrong. That may have been the nail in the coffin of Romney's campaign, because you've really had media turning significantly against him now too, because the Beltway media were themselves also significantly horrified by this. Meanwhile, the protests have been going on, not just in Egypt and Libya now, but in over 20 different countries. The interesting part about the initial protests, the Libyan government immediately condemned the violence and the protests, but the Egyptian government, now led by the Muslim Brotherhood and Prime Minister Morsi, very pointedly did not. In fact, they had a government-sponsored day of outrage against the movie on Friday, which happily the violence didn't escalate on that, but they very pointedly did not condemn the violence at the American embassy in Cairo. Some of that's for domestic political reasons, but nonetheless, it's a very troubling indication of where the American relationship with the Egyptian government might be going in the future. Anyway, seeing all this going on and seeing American personnel, including an ambassador, die, and seeing Muslims looking really bad because they're rioting over a movie trailer on the internet that until these protests happened, nobody would have seen or heard of, must make Pastor Terry Jones very happy. And for that, I'm terribly sad.
All right. Yemen.
Yeah, 12 people killed Tuesday in a car bomb targeting Yemen's defense minister. So even before the anti-American protests, and Yemen is one of the countries where those are happening as well, things starting to fall apart in Yemen. Now, the car bombing there was stated to be in retaliation for the killing of a Al-Qaeda in Yemen, an oppositional leader, earlier. Now, it wasn't the Yemeni government, though, that killed that leader. It was drones launched by the United States. And so, remarkably enough, a number of U.S. media accounts, although international accounts in Canada and Britain did actually mention this, American accounts generally did not, that car bombing was a direct response to something the United States did, not something the Yemeni government did. And the context for this is that after the longtime dictator in Yemen stepped down last year, his longtime associate and vice president took the helm, and that move was largely engineered behind the scenes by the United States, and that also is why people are predisposed at that and the countless drone deaths of civilians over the last several years in Yemen is why Al-Qaeda is getting a foothold there, why other tribal militants are getting a foothold there, and why there's a lot of resentment of the United States.
All right, events.
Today at 4 o'clock, there's a forum and fundraiser for the Chicago teacher strike. Even though there's a tentative resolution on that, you probably want to find out more in the forum about the issues behind it. And the fundraiser, of course, a lot of those teachers did forego a week's pay, and there were a lot of costs associated with that strike that will still need to be paid back. That's at the Labor Temple, 2800 First at Broad in beautiful downtown Belltown. Also, Monday the 17th is the first anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, which, of course, also launched Occupy Seattle and Occupy encampments and movements in literally hundreds of cities across the country. It was and remains a big deal. That anniversary is going to be marked by a silent flash mob. Gather at 6 o'clock and then a silent flash march at 6:30 at Westlake Park, Fourth and Pine in downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is at www.eatthestate.org. And if you want to help support a person who is fighting off a cold, Maria's work is at www.mariatomchik.com.